Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 152, I chat with video calibrators Michael Chen and Ray Coronado about Michael's instructional videos. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 25th, 2013. Episode 152, Video Calibration Video. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week's guest geeks are Michael Chen, a video calibrator and THX video instructor. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey again, Scott.
That's right. You're second time on the show. Glad to have you back.
And thanks for having me back.
You bet. Also, another second time guest here, Ray Coronado, a video calibrator in Southern California and known to everyone in the chat room as SoCal Ray Jr. Hey, Ray, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So before we get started, I want to make sure that everybody knows that if you are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, you can post questions for Michael and Ray, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Okay, what we're going to talk about today is video calibration, a very mysterious subject. And I get a lot of comments, a lot of email from people who say, I want to know more about this video calibration thing. How does it work? What's it about? How do I learn how to do it? I mean, can I go and tag along with a video calibrator when they go out on a job and really see how it works? Well, Michael, you and Ray both do a lot of this. Would you want someone tagging along to observe what you're doing, Michael?
Well, I guess starting off, the answer is, well, it seems sort of like an interesting idea. When I go to a client's place, I have to spend my time with the client, the guy who's paying me, and it's just not quite right to divert all the attention to the person that's tagging along with you. So the client kind of gets cheated, and I that's just unfair to the client.
I think I agree with that. I can't imagine doing it any other way. Ray, I think you've expressed a similar sentiment, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. My time there is, you know, to calibrate the customer's display and to help them out and explain everything as much as I can. To actually, you know, like Michael says, take time away from them is kind of cheating them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. And yet, there are books on the subject, I suppose. And you could take a class like the THX certification class that, Michael, you teach. And ISF makes a certification class as well, offers one. But those are pretty expensive. What's the THX class going for these days?
If you take them both at the same time, there's a level one and a level two. It's $2,000, but separate, they're $600 and $1,600.
And you have to spend, and the first one, I think, is one day or 2 days, and the next one's a couple days?
Absolutely. Level one is one day, and level two is the other 2 days.
Right. So, you know, you got to commit 3 days and a couple grand to really, really learn how to calibrate video displays. And I must admit, I've taken the THX class, and it's really good because there's a lot of hands-on. You can actually play with the equipment and see all the test patterns that you need to use and get instruction from people like Michael, who really know their stuff. But it's a big commitment. So, Michael, you came up with an idea, and Ray, you helped him, to maybe offer what these people who write me ask for, which is, how do I get a sense of what's really involved in video calibration without having to spend so much money and so much time? Michael, how did you come up with the idea of presenting a series of videos?
Well, the genesis of all this stuff actually happened about 5 years ago. I was halfway across the country in Ottawa, and a person wanted me to calibrate their TV, except they said that they couldn't be there because they were off on some training course. So they asked if it would be all right if they effectively had their wife tape the entire, record the entire session. So I said, yeah, sure. So I actually gave the entire presentation, 4 or 5 hour presentation, to nobody sitting in the room.
That must have felt a little weird.
Absolutely. It was really weird. I would move the camera around and I would show, you know, the graphs and all that. But after doing that, it showed me, it taught me that, hey, I actually don't need anybody in the room when I can do a presentation. And since I did that, you could literally turn it into a canned presentation. And that's, you know, that's how all of this stuff actually began. And a year later, I was sitting in a car driving down to Portland, and I was with some industry guys, and I kind of brought up this idea, and they said, hey, yeah, you know, sounds great. And that's kind of how we started moving in that direction. And then you started getting these questions from the people in the class as they learn about this stuff. But they would always ask you, well, how do you tie all this stuff together? Because you would only learn one concept at a time, and they wanted me to somehow show them an example of just how do you do it all together. And that just really pushed it. And then last year I made them.
Mm. And Ray, how did you get involved?
Well, I guess my take on it is Michael and me were just kind of sitting around, and I guess for lack of better words, I was moral support. And once he started videoing or recording the sessions, then I kind of helped out in figuring out how we should edit them, what we should put in as comments in the lower third, that kind of thing. And, you know, basically just a lot of brainstorming with Michael and helping him out in any way that I could, as, you know, Michael and me interact a lot, almost on a daily basis. So it just kind of felt natural to give him a hand.
Good. Well, and certainly you're extremely experienced in this whole area as well. So the collaboration, I'm sure, was very good.
I do need Ray to tell me how my son's doing. You're still holding him hostage.
What? Well, I think once we sort of sort this whole display calibration video thing out, I bet you it'll be time to return your son to you.
Yes.
Michael, what is, tell us the basics. What is video calibration all about? Why does somebody need to do that?
Ah, okay. Well, the basics of video calibration is actually here. I just have a random, like a disc, and it's actually about making your TV that you have at home look as close to the studio grade monitor that the filmmakers are using when they're making the disc. And that's, so you want your TV to look like a studio grade monitor, because that's what the filmmakers were looking at when they were creating that particular Blu-ray disc or DVD disc for. Mind you, if you don't care about what the colors are, then, you know, life goes on and you're happy. But if colors don't matter, then why do the studios spend millions of dollars tweaking the colors on films if colors don't matter? And for some people, colors do matter, and this is where the whole calibration stuff comes in. We're trying to make your TV look like a studio grade monitor.
And they don't look like that coming out of the box?
No, not at all. Because of the basic premise, and you actually kind of get you learn this after you're in the industry for a while, which is the marketing of a TV set has nothing to do with presenting accurate images. It actually has everything to do with selling more TVs. And you know, and I always say to people, well, if you owned a TV company and your marketing people came and told you that they just found out that if you made pictures purple, people would buy more TVs, then what do? Make them purple.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to sell as many TVs as you can.
Yes, and that's why TVs don't come correct out of the box. And they never will.
Because that's not how they get the most sales.
Absolutely.
So what do they look like coming out of the box that allows them to sell better?
Well, typically coming out of the box, well, until just recently with a little gift from California, but until recently, they would come out looking really, really bright and much bluer than they actually should be. And this was actually a result of something that TV people learned from the laundry detergent, which was that if you added, you know, laundry detergent, if you added blue dye into your laundry detergent and you dyed white, slightly blue-white, people would actually see it better. And how that works is because our eyes actually pick up on the blue part a lot better than we actually see white. And so you can trick people into thinking images are brighter and you can get their attention a lot better by playing tricks with the colors.
Hmm. And so, Ray, you must have visited Best Buys and other places where there are walls of TVs and seen what I've seen, and I'm sure Michael has as well, that all the TVs on the floor are very bright, trying to compete for your eyeballs, really.
Yeah, like I've told my customers, most of those TVs are way too bright because last time I looked, nobody had a wall of 10 TVs in their house or a ceiling full of fluorescent tubes.
Right. So
you actually have to definitely set up the TV to the viewing environment. And out of the box is normally not that, not that proper setting.
Michael, you mentioned something about a gift from California. What were you referring to there?
the gift from California came a few years ago when a law was passed that the TVs had to consume like 30 or 40% less energy than they do, you know, at the time. And so what had happened was we actually joked at the time that the TV manufacturers weren't really going to do anything to their TVs. They would just retweak the TVs and send them out in a dimmer mode. And at the time, we thought they would just do movie mode. But what a lot of the manufacturers actually did was they retweaked their standard mode and they made the mode so dim that it consumed so little energy that it met all those energy requirements. However, it made the picture completely unwatchable. So the moment someone takes that out of the box, this is unwatchable, they'll go directly to the vivid or the dynamic mode, and then they're right back to normal again, wasting energy.
Right back to what is normal for a showroom floor, you mean?
Absolutely, yes. But by doing this, the so-called energy-saving stuff, they could put those energy stickers on their TV and claim that everybody would only spend $20 in energy a year on their TVs when nobody actually does.
Right. Because they turn it back into this high brightness, dynamic, or vivid mode, which consumes a heck of a lot more power.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, exactly right. Somebody in the chat room here is asking how much for a true video calibration, and you know, I know that it's variable. It may be somewhat of a sensitive subject. Might not want to reveal your price list on the air, but what can you say about it?
Ray, yeah, you talk about this.
Okay.
Pass the buck, won't you?
Yeah.
That's fine. I would say that a standard video calibration, depending on what needs to be done, can vary anywhere from, let's say, $350 up to $500, $600, depending on the scope of the work. My guesstimate would be most panels with decent amount of controls to be able to take care of everything, going to be right around the $350 mark with add-ons if you're going to be doing like an external scaler where you're going to do color management in there or actually a separate 3D calibration, because that in itself is another complete calibration of the same panel. And then, you know, projectors get into more because you have to play with geometry, alignment, and it's just a lot more involved job to calibrate a projector.
Yeah, so as seems reasonable, you know, the amount of work dictates how much it's going to cost.
Correct.
Usually just kind of figure it's anywhere between like $350 and $550 or $600, depending on what you ask for.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody in here mentioned, and I'm trying to look for the comment. I don't see it immediately, but they were talking about how their father tried to do a visual calibration, that is just by eye, which is not something you would recommend, right?
Well, if you do it by eye, that's actually just call it eyeballing, but you'll never be able to get it accurate because the eyes are so easily fooled. You may get it to something that you like, but you could never claim that it was actually what the picture was supposed to look like. So, you know, ideally and by the book, there's no way you can do it.
Right. You need some sort of instrumentation. And this is one reason why it actually costs what it does, $350 to $500-$600, because the calibrator, the person who does it, needs to have some pretty expensive equipment and, as we've already learned, some pretty expensive training.
Right.
Yep.
So I always like to separate calibration, which requires this expensive equipment and this expensive training, from the what I call basic setup. Mm-hmm. So, Ray, give us a little sense of the difference between those two things.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at the chat, and it looks like Eric Duckman hit it right on the head.
Okay, good.
Yeah, the basic setup is your brightness, contrast, color, and tint. That you can normally do by eye with the proper, you know, test disc, that kind of thing.
And test disc would be something like the Spears and Munsell, or the Video Essentials, or the Spears and Munsell High Definition Benchmark. Or the Disney Wow disc for those people who aren't seriously technical. I actually like that disc quite a bit.
Correct. One of the other discs that actually I really like, and I leave one with every one of my customers, and it's actually what we used to base Michael's calibration series on, is a disc that comes from AVS, and it's called the AVS 709 disc. And what happened is a bunch of guys from AVS put that disc together, and it's got all your basic test patterns on there, and it's in the AVCHD format, so you can burn it to a regular DVD, but your Blu-ray player sees it as a full 1080 high-def video signal.
Really?
And that is 100% completely free.
And you can download it from AVS. I have to say, now that I'm a member of AVS, I'm really happy that AVS offers that service. You can just download it into your computer, burn it onto a DVD. But since it's high definition, you can't. The amount of space on a DVD is still fixed, and so you certainly couldn't put a whole movie on a DVD at that resolution.
Exactly. And like I said, this is actually, the content is what's called an AVCHD content. It's a high def content. It's a full 1920 by 1080 resolution content, but it's not encoded as a Blu-ray. But your Blu-ray player will see it as full 1080 content. So the patterns are correct. The levels for the shades of gray you need for calibrating are correct. The patterns for brightness, contrast, color, and tint are all correct. Your one-to-one pixel mapping patterns are all correct. So it's a real, real easy solution for someone that wants to just go through and set up their display. But, you know, that, in my opinion, that disc has some of the best patterns for setting brightness and contrast that I've seen anywhere. And they're absolutely free. The other thing is,
at the beginning was as we played around with that. Well, what disc or how should the videos actually be done? Should the test patterns be from a signal generator, or should they be from some kind of a test disc that's on the market? And we settled on the one that was free because so that you could watch the videos and you weren't actually required to go out and spend any more money.
That is 100% correct.
Which is great. Which is absolutely great. A couple more quick questions. Terry K asks, is video calibration a done deal once it's done, or do you have to recalibrate periodically? Michael, what do you say to that?
Let's see. And the answer is yes and no. It's one of those, it depends. What I found, if you remember the old Pioneer Curl plasma TVs,
I have one in my theater right now.
What I found, although they're no longer being manufactured and haven't been done for a few years, like I've gone back 3 years now and 4 years after the fact for some of the people's TVs, and those things they didn't drift a single bit. So for those sets, literally, if you had one calibration, it's pretty much good for the lifetime of that TV.
The same is not going to be true of a projector or a rear projection TV, though, certainly, right, because of the lamp.
Absolutely, and the same does not really apply to like the lesser like flat panel TVs. It just happened to be those Pioneer ones that just were rock solid for years. But the stuff, some of the Panasonics, the LGs, the Samsungs, the Sonys, they typically would drift enough within 2 to 2.5 years that it would be worthwhile to do a retweak on those again. But those, so those weren't definitely a one time and never again.
Mm-hmm. So it's a case by case basis, probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was also going to say the other big thing is not so much now, but when you had a lamp-based device like the DLPs and the SXRDs or any type of projector, that calibration is only as good as the life of the lamp.
Right, right. As soon as you put a new lamp in there, you better do the calibration again for sure.
Yeah, and that's correct.
I mean, the lamp ages over time. Hopefully, the good news... In the best situation, the lamp settles down after, I don't know, 50, 100 hours maybe, and hopefully plateaus for a long time in its color characteristics and its brightness and so on, slowly degrading in brightness probably over time, hopefully the slower the better, until at some point it finally starts falling off and you really better replace it.
Yeah, that's pretty much correct. We're taught that in... when I was in the THX class, and I actually have to validate a lot of things before I fully believe them. And I actually got a projector, a brand new projector. It had maybe 5 hours on it, calibrated the projector. About 50 to 100 hours, I came back. And what I noticed is originally when I calibrated, I took a lot of blue out of the signal. And when I came back, yeah, it was... You know, red and green stayed pretty much the same, but blue had dropped off dramatically, and it was pretty much a linear to the other one. So I had to put it all back in, whatever I had taken out. But, you know, basically after that, it seemed that everything kind of stayed very, very linear and didn't degrade. You know, one color didn't degrade too much from the others.
Mm-hmm. Another really interesting question here in the chat room. Midnight Rider asks, can someone who is colorblind do calibrations? Michael, what do you think?
It's going to be pretty hard, but I wouldn't. Okay. Technically, you should be able to do it, but right at the end, you literally have to set aside all the graphs and all the technical stuff that you've been doing, because ultimately you have to judge whether or not the calibration is successful by looking at real life material, real reference material. And if you're colorblind, that makes it difficult because you're not seeing what the other person is seeing. And that makes it really difficult. So you could sign off on an image that looks right to you, except it could be very wrong. And that's the danger of this.
I tend to agree. Someone who is colorblind could use a meter, a color meter, and software such as Calman from SpectraCal, and get everything so that it measures properly. But this brings up the whole question of objective versus subjective. And when something measures correctly, does that necessarily mean that it looks as good as it can? What do you think, Michael? Or Ray, go ahead.
Ray.
Well, Michael, I'm sure, has a lot more comments on this, but that is one thing that him and I have both gone back and forth with, where we've measured displays and they measure textbook. You put up an image and you're like, oh, my God, what the hell happened? but, I mean, you know, single color, single pattern, single shade, everything works correctly. Ultimately, when you feed it live content or real content, the decoder just freaks out or whatever's going on just goes nuts. And ultimately, you have to go back to what looks correct, even if it doesn't measure 100% correct.
Absolutely. This is one of the dangers that a lot of the enthusiasts out there, the do-it-yourself guys, the only way they can demonstrate how well their TV is performing is they just share graphs with each other. They can't share what the picture actually looks like. So you have this graph sharing process, but our experience just tells us that in real life, looking at perfect graphs, I've seen plenty of perfect graphs and awful images. A person shows me a graph, it tells me nothing.
Well, it doesn't tell you nothing. Certainly doesn't tell you the whole story.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. It does, there's no guarantee that the guy's image is actually very good. It just shows me he's got a really nice-looking graph.
Right. Right. Exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit about your video. So your solution to the problem of how do I bring along someone who wants to watch me calibrate? Can't do that because really you're on the customer's dime and you can't have a intern or a student come along as that'll take away from the customer's time. So you decided from one customer who decided to video you while you were doing the whole thing. You said, hey, I could do this and offer it to people. So
yes.
How many do you have? How are they broken up? We have one image, I think, of some of the videos that you have available on your website, which is, remind us of the URL of your website.
It's www.tlvexp. So that stands for the Laser Video Experience. .com and you can go there and in the store and there's a bunch of articles on the particular series of videos.
Right, and we saw for a moment there the image of 24 videos now. Actually,
we're at 26 now, and I'm at and 27 is coming.
Oh, what do you know? And it's a little difficult to see the labels, so the titles of those videos. So give us a few so we can get a sense of what each one covers.
Ah, okay. Well, think of it as it is a breakdown of the entire calibration process. So the first video is setting up the equipment, and then it's quite literally a breakdown of exactly what I say to a client when I'm in their house. So and then you just go through this. This video is on contrast, and this video is on sharpness, and so forth. And the whole thing here is because this is a literally a reproduction of what I say to a client. I don't use a single techno babble term in any of these videos. That everything is spoken in plain, simple English, and everybody can understand it.
That's great. In fact, we have a link to one of your videos that I wanted to show people just to give them a sense of what we're doing here. This is video number 19, I believe, John. If we can pull that up, here we go. This is on a very technical subject called Delta E.
Welcome to another video. I'm Michael Chen, and this video is about the concept of Delta E. What I have here is our CIE chart. This is every color that the human eye can see. Hopefully we've seen this before. And there's a dotted line that goes this way and a dotted line that goes that way. Where these two dotted lines crisscross, that point is 313329. That's the D65 point that we're, when people go to get taught how to calibrate TVs, that's our magic point, the neutral point. We're always trying to calibrate to this point, 313329. And that's where neutral black and white is for our TV system. So, in THX class, in ISF class, from a professional perspective, that's where everyone is taught, and I say, well, that's perfect. However, as everybody gets out into the field and they start working on people's TV sets, TV after TV, what the calibrators quickly found out is that that's the theoretical. Unfortunately, we're never really going to get there with our equipment because the hardware that we have to deal with, all the TVs in the field, unfortunately, don't behave perfectly. You get one point to be perfect and then like an 80% point to be perfect, and then your 60% point is not perfect, and your 30% point is not perfect. You can never get there. So you fix some of the other points, and then you're literally chasing yourself around, chasing your tail, because you can never get to perfect. And that's, and that creates a lot of frustration, and especially, new calibrators, because they know they need to get to this perfect point, 313329. Unfortunately, they find out they can never get there because the TVs don't behave perfectly. So what do? Well, enter the whole concept of Delta E. And the Delta E concept is, it's effectively an acknowledgement that we can't get to perfect, but how close to perfect is good enough, given the equipment that we're using and the TVs that we're dealing with. So the whole idea here is we know we can't get the perfect, so what's close enough? So from a calibration perspective, let's just say delta E, large numbers are bad and small numbers are good. So if our TV is perfect, the delta E formula would kick out a number of zero. You are perfect. There is no error. However, if your TV is really bad, the program kicks out a number that says, oh, you're 50. Well, that's really bad. So what's good and what's bad in the world of delta E? Well, if you have a delta E number of 10 or less, that is considered to be tolerable to the human eye. And what does that mean? Well, tolerable typically means that if you're watching a TV program, let's say, you can say to yourself, yeah, man, I can tell that that program is green-tinted. However, it's not so green, it makes me not want to watch it. So in that sense, you tolerate it, and that's what, you know, 10 or less considered to be a tolerable error to the human eye. Now, if you have an error of 5 or less, that is considered to be very good performance for a consumer-grade TV set. And, well, what does that mean? Well, this is a consumer-grade TV set, and pretty much every TV you're going to encounter in anybody's home is consumer-grade. And if you're a calibrator, it's probably a good idea to mention that to the client, that, hey, very good performance for a consumer-grade TV set, which, by the way, you have a consumer-grade TV set, because how much would our TVs cost if they were military-grade or commercial-grade? Let's just say a heck of a lot more. Add a couple of zeros onto whatever you paid for your TV set. So 5 or less is very good performance for a consumer-grade TV set. And then 3 or less is considered to be effectively perfect. And what is meant by effectively perfect? Well, what is meant is that my spectrometer, our color meters, can actually measure an error of, say, 0.5. However, as far as the human eye is concerned, if you measure 0.5 or 2.5, the human eye can't actually tell the difference. So when we say 3 or less, we're effectively saying that it's beyond human perception. Yes, our meters, our measuring instruments can see the difference, can see the error, but the human eye can't see the error anymore. And it's good to understand that.
Very good. Okay, let's. I think we've seen enough there to get a sense of these videos. The Delta E one that you picked is a pretty... That's a pretty technical topic, but it's also number 19 in a series of 26, 27 now. So presumably...
Absolutely.
You've watched numbers 1 through 18, so you're already getting a sense of what's going on by the time you get there, right?
Yeah. Because the way the video series works, like, literally, is if I were in a consumer's home, by the time I get to about part 12, part 13... That's it. That's all the end consumer would hear, because the entire series is over 6 hours long now, and we don't spend more than 4 hours in a person's home, and we actually have to still calibrate the TV there.
So you're not there just to educate. You have to actually do some work.
Yes. So the stuff that was added after about part 12 and part 13, it was, well, what else can I do? What else can I do? Now we can focus on some of the more esoteric topics in calibration and at least sort of give that stuff a more understandable face.
Exactly. Now, one thing I noticed in that video, and I'm sure it's true in virtually all the videos you have done, you have to shoot this video with images on a screen, a video screen.
Absolutely.
Did that present any particular challenges? It seems like it would to me in terms of reflection. You guys are both laughing, of course. So clearly I've touched a nerve.
like you wouldn't believe.
Okay. Ray, give us some sense of the challenges that presents.
Well, what ended up happening, that was one of the biggest things that, I mean, what the customers get there is definitely not take 1, 2, 3. I don't even think it's take 5 of the initial 1 through 3 videos. We literally, Michael would make a video. We would look at it and say, okay, how can we make it better? It even got to the point where we were doing picture in picture screen grabs, because you couldn't tell the difference on the display because it was so subtle. This is actually on some of the other ones, like setting brightness, setting contrast, color, tint. And yeah, like I said, every one of these videos was kind of a work in progress and learning something new and how can we kind of fight the problem and solve it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, Michael knows exactly how difficult all that was.
When you consider that, well, it's not like we didn't realize what this stuff was actually looking at or the limitations of my family room. and because of that, some of that text commentary that you actually see going along the bottom can't be said that we don't have a sense of humor, because I actually do point out certain bizarre things every so often, like well, some of the other ones, such as, did you know that it's actually 95 degrees in this room right now as I'm shooting this video? Right. And the sound that you hear is actually a fan going, an oscillating fan moving in the background or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Big Ginge in the chat room is asking, compared to the THX calibration course, how much is this, how much does this cover in term as opposed to the THX calibration course? And if you watch all of it, can you get any credit towards the THX calibration course?
Well, unfortunately, you can't get any credit towards the class. They still want your money.
Yeah, they still want your money.
Yeah, but beyond that, in terms of how much stuff is covered, let's just say that if you attended the class, since I'm one of the instructors, I'm literally repeating everything I say in the class. So you are literally sitting in on a class, a THX class that is compressed it down into 6 hours. You just take out all the hands-on time and all the washroom breaks and all that other stuff in a THX class, but you're getting the bulk of the same lecture that you're going to get in a THX class.
Right. The information presented is roughly the same. What you're missing out is the hands-on experience. And, of course, as you say, lunch breaks and so on. How important is that hands-on experience, though?
Well, if you're taking a class, absolutely. It is very important. And that's why the videos are fashioned the way they are, which is you can read stuff about how to do something, but sometimes reading, it's back to that thing of, you know, pictures are worth 1,000 words. But when you actually see a person actually doing it, you can, you know, you have that same disc in hand and you can replicate what I did on the TV set. You can replicate it on your TV set almost right away. And if you don't quite get it, you can play back the video 100 times until you do understand what I'm showing you.
Right. That does certainly make a big difference, because you can't rewind in a live class. Chiebert in the chat room is asking, and this is our good friend Chiebert, who's on Padre SJ's Twiet show. He's an enterprise guy and knows his stuff there very well. And he asks, will consumer TVs drift faster, and I would add, or more, than commercial-grade TVs or displays? Michael, you were mentioning commercial-grade versus consumer-grade before. Are you going to get tighter tolerances and longer time between recalibration on a commercial-grade set as compared to consumer?
And the answer is the Pioneer Elites were a lot closer to what the well, commercial grade stuff was. That's one of the reasons why they cost so much. And I'd mentioned that they don't drift after 4 years, 5 years. So, but the consumer stuff, the $400, the $1,000 TVs, I find that stuff drifts and you need to retweak it within 2 to 2.5 years. That it drifts enough that you'll notice.
Right. But you're saying, am I correct? You're saying then that commercial grade displays will not drift that much, typically.
I have played with some Panasonic commercial grade stuff in some post-production studios. I actually go back there every 3 months, and I've been doing it for like 2 years at one place. And every time I relook at one of those, the same monitor again and again, and there's no change at all. However, at the same time, their JVC projector, which is consumer grade, It needs, in that type of a situation, how they use it, I have to recalibrate that every 3 months.
Right. But again, that's a lamp-based product. They're probably using it all the time. It's probably on, you know, 10, 12 hours a day at least, if not 24 hours a day.
Absolutely. And the plasma is on exactly the same amount of time, and it effectively doesn't change. It did not change.
Amazing. Let's see. A bad boot sector in the chat room has a good question. If it takes 4 hours to do a calibration, how do you deal with the change in ambient light? Which I'm pretty sure is referring to the fact that in most homes, you don't have a light-sealed room.
Ray. Give that to Ray.
I'll give this one to Ray. You know, so if you go in at a certain time of day, if you go in during the day, for example, there'll probably be some ambient light in there. And then what do? Wait around till it gets dark and do it again for nighttime mode? Also, tell us about daytime versus nighttime mode. Those two questions are related.
Okay, well, we do the first one in the morning. I come back at noon and then one in the evening just to get it all right.
Do you really?
No.
Oh, I didn't think so. You're joking. You're pulling my leg.
No, basically, the process I use is I do grayscale, and I use a contact meter. So part of the thing is the ambient light doesn't affect it as much when the meter is directly on the display.
Well, that's so a good point. And let's quickly just point out that there are sort of two types of colorimeters that we use for this calibration process. One is a contact type, which is like sometimes called a puck. The spider is an example, not a particularly good one, I think, but there are others that actually make contact with the screen. And so the ambient light doesn't really make much of an effect. Then there are those that you set away from the display and shoot the display. It has a lens on it and it looks like a camera, sort of like a video camera that's you're pointing at the display and it's some distance away, which you have to use for projectors. You can't do anything but that with a projector. But with a flat panel or a direct view TV, you can use a contact meter, which is what you tend to use, right?
Correct. Now, just to clarify something, the contact meter doesn't always have to be a colorimeter. I use an i1 Pro, which is a contact spectral radiometer.
And let's just quickly mention the difference between a colorimeter and a spectral radiometer.
Okay. Well, a colorimeter uses a filter, a colored filter pack, for lack of better words, to let the light through. And then there's a sensor on the back end that looks at the difference. If your panel, like some of these new wide gamut LED displays, have emit light that is outside the realm of that colored filter pack, you're going to get erroneous reads, or you're going to get reads that may look right in the software, but visually don't look correct.
And this is an example of something that might happen where you get a correct looking measurement, but then the picture looks lousy.
Correct. Now, on the opposite end, you have a spectral radiometer, which looks at the full light array regardless of, it doesn't have filters. It looks at the actual light waveform and breaks it down to the individual spectral arrays, which is a far more accurate way of doing it. It doesn't get fooled or anything by like wide gamut LEDs or something outside of the quote unquote normal RGB, because it's not using filters to try to guess what the color of light is coming through. So right. Spectral radiometer is just a lot more accurate over a larger gamut of display types over a colorimeter.
It's also going to generally be more expensive, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, it's more expensive. It's a little bit slower when you're taking reads. You know, it may take you a little bit longer to do the calibration. But like I've told many people, calibrating is about accuracy. It's not a race. So
right. Beatrice in the chat room is asking a related question. What's the difference between a spectroradiometer and a spectrophotometer? Or are they just two different words for the same thing?
As far as I know, I think they're actually the same thing, different terminology.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what I think. They're the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, as far as Michael and Ray are both concerned, they're just two different names for the same thing. The other thing you'll hear about colorimeters versus spectroradiometers is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ray, a colorimeter is sometimes known as a tri-stimulus device?
Correct. It's referring to the three color filter packs that are in there, the red, green, blue.
Right. And a question much earlier in the chat room that is now the perfect time to ask is, what do you do when the colors coming off the TV do not match the red, green, and blue filters in a tri-stimulus colorimeter?
You grab it, you throw it out the window, and you go buy yourself a spectral radiometer.
Well, okay.
No, there actually is another solution.
Or you could do something else, yes.
Yes, there is. There is another solution, and the other solution, unfortunately, involves that you still have a spectral radiometer, and it is called profiling. You can create an offset table from your spectral radiometer to your colorimeter to correct the deficiency of the colorimeter. The problem is you have to do it on a display-by-display basis. So just because you created an offset for your LG LED panel does not mean that that same offset will work on the Samsung LED panel or even an LG of a different series panel. So you have to create an offset for every single one to be 100% accurate.
100% accurate, I can understand. But doesn't CalMan, the software from SpectraCal that most of us use, include offsets for different display types like LED and plasma and I guess fluorescent LCD and so on? Are those good enough or are they just not very good?
They're better than nothing, but it's kind of like creating a generic calibration file of that type of display. Let's say they measured 10 LGs with CCFL lighting, and they said the average offset is this. Okay, well, if you have one display that's at the opposite end of that average, it's not going to be correct. And like I've said before, calibration is about making a display correct. If you're not worried about making it as correct as possible, why calibrate in the first place?
Well, true enough there. Michael, what do you think about calibrating at a particular time of day when you might not have complete control of ambient light? And then how does that relate to what it will look like at night, for example, if you go in during the day? Do you also, for example, use a contact meter as opposed to one that shoots from away from the screen?
While I do have a contact meter, which is my backup, I rarely take it out. What I do is I do the really primitive, if not funny thing, which is I usually ask if it's like daytime and they don't have light control, I ask the client to find a really dark bed sheet or a dark blanket or something, and they come out and I drape it over the TV set. And then I crawl under the TV set like the old days with the guys in the camera. And I take a reading of a few patterns, and then I remove the blanket and I take the same readings, and then I observe how much difference there are. And if I find that the readings don't change that much, I'll actually continue to do it in the daytime, you know, in that well lit room, and I will only fine tune close to the end when I'm done.
Now I also wanted, Michael, you can address this. I wanted to sort of make sure people understood that. In most cases, you could calibrate a TV twice. You could calibrate it for daytime viewing and for nighttime viewing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, daytime and nighttime. It's kind of funny. I actually have a video on that. But
why am I not surprised?
Nighttime, you just figure all the lights turned off. And that's pretty consistent. But the problem when you're dealing with the so-called daytime mode is you always have to get people to understand that it's daytime modes only work if the light is consistent during the daytime. And so are we talking about morning sun, noon sun, afternoon sun, evening sun? Is it winter? Is it summer? Are the leaves on the trees? because all those conditions change the type of lighting that's in the room. And as long as the lighting in the room keeps changing, you cannot properly calibrate the TV to account for one kind of light. All you can do is literally you take your optimal calibration from the nighttime and you will probably increase the backlight and you'll probably pump up the brightness control to make the blacks a bit easier to see. But anyone who thinks that they can get accuracy with the light in the room changing all the time, they're dreaming. It cannot be done.
So this is probably certainly why I tend to, when I'm calibrating a TV for a review, I do it in a light sealed dark room because I know that that is a consistent, I mean, everybody, whoever can totally get the light out of their room can achieve that same result. Whereas I have no idea if I calibrate during the day, whether the lighting conditions that I'm under are anything like the lighting conditions that somebody else is going to be under with that same set.
And that's precisely it.
Yeah, exactly right. Had another question here. Dr. T asks, what are we calibrating for? HDMI input, TV, cable, Blu-ray? And this is actually, this was a question that I wanted to bring up. When we calibrate, when you guys calibrate, when I calibrate, typically you're using a what's called a signal generator, which is a little box that generates a certain set of test patterns that we then measure and tweak and so on. But people don't watch a test pattern generator. They watch a Blu-ray player or they watch a cable box or satellite box or something like that. How do you account for any differences between those different source devices?
Hey, Ray, that's not my problem.
Ray, let's start with you.
Well, I guess let me start it off by saying we calibrate to the SMPTE standards. And the only thing out there that meets those standards 100% is probably Blu-ray mastering. Because for some bizarre reason, every broadcast engineer has a better idea of what their signal coming out of the station should look like. So you will never, ever, ever be able to calibrate a display for broadcast TV, period.
What about, to interrupt you just for a second, what about, I understand what you're saying. Each TV station is going to be a little different. And I've always wondered, how am I going to calibrate for broadcast? Now, HDNet broadcasts a few test patterns, like at 3 a.m. every couple of weeks. Is that of any help at all? Have you ever seen those?
Actually, yes, I have. I have them on my DVR. What I have found is those patterns are usable for HDNet.
yes, exactly right. Good.
You go to any other channel, and like I've said, every broadcast engineer has a better idea of what their signal should look like. So there really is no calibrating for broadcast TV. You can, you know, you can hope that once you calibrate the display, that the image they see with broadcast improves. But you really, 99% of the time, have no way to control that. Mm-hmm. But like you were saying, we do calibrate with signal generators that put out reference patterns at a reference HDMI level. So we calibrate there. And then what I was taught in THX class was you work backwards from the display. Once I calibrate that, then we go through the receiver or pre-pro and run the signal generator through it and make sure that the receiver pre-pro is not changing the signal in any way, shape, or form. So I put up test patterns again, take measurements, take a look. Then we go to the Blu-ray player. And that's where our test discs come in. Now I drop in a test disc and I bring up my brightness patterns, my contrast patterns, color tint. And most Blu-ray players have very basic adjustments where if your brightness level is not correct, you can correct it coming out of the Blu-ray player. Your contrast level is not correct, you can correct that as well. You can make a slight change in color and tint if you need to correct that as well. So that, you know, that part of the chain can be calibrated very, very accurately. And you just hope that everything else falls close enough to that. And like I said, I've yet to find any cable boxes, satellite boxes that allow any kind of brightness, contrast, color, tint adjustments to try to help improve the signal in any way, shape, or form.
Now, Michael, didn't didn't THX at one time include their setup patterns, which are collectively known as THX Optimizer? Weren't those included on some TiVo boxes at some point?
Yes, I think that they were. Well, some of the TiVo boxes, I think they were actually THX certified.
Exactly.
But yes, they were included, and it's a case of it's better than nothing. Because it's back to that thing of you can control what the TiVo will output, but if all the signals that go through the TiVo don't conform to what the signal is supposed to look like, then it's like you have your perfect box, except nothing that you send into it is perfect. And
right.
You're still going to get what you get.
Yeah, yeah.
So those optimizer things were considered to be, it's better than nothing.
Right. Just like the HDNet test patterns that they broadcast every couple of weeks are better than
absolutely
nothing.
Yeah.
But it's not anywhere near entirely what you need to get every station looking its best, because there's no way to know.
Correct.
Well,
you cross
I guess
your fingers.
I guess I could make a trek across America and try to correct every broadcast engineer.
I suppose you could. Let's say you did. Let's not and say you did. Okay, well, we're just about out of time here. But, Michael, I just want to get a final sense from you of what do people need to do to watch all this 6 hours plus and more to come of video? I think you do charge something for it.
Okay. If you buy the videos from my site, the videos cost, as an entire package, it's $150 for the 26 videos right now. And if I make anything more, you can get that. It's just all included. I'll give you access to the new ones. Access is for 6 months. And you can also buy the videos individually at $10 a pop. Although I'd advise you, that's not very cost effective. Mm. So, consider the full price thing. But, Scott also does stuff for Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity.
Yep.
And you can go through the Secrets, their question and answer site. There's a link to my site, and you can buy those same series of videos for $100 instead of what I sell them for, $150 on my site. So you can save a bit more money.
Very good. I'm so glad to know that. And you go through the portal on my page on Secrets, which is the Q&A page.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, where else can you get them?
Well, the ISF forum, actually, the ISF calibrators actually have access to them on a separate, on their own site. And our THX people have access to it on their own site as well.
Okay, so from your site or from Secrets, and if you're an ISF or THX calibrator, you can get them there as well. One last question about that. These are videos are all on YouTube, right? But you need some sort of special access to get to them. You can't just go to YouTube and go there.
Absolutely. This is what I would call my feeble attempt at copy protection. And so the way it kind of works is back to that thing of, I put some work into this thing and I'd like to be compensated for my work. However, how it works on YouTube is after you purchase the stuff from me and I get the PayPal notice, then I actually send you an email with, like right now, 26 links. And I take the email address that you use on YouTube, and I will go into those 26 videos, and I will pop your email address into each one of those videos. And when you click those links on that one email that I send you, you will have access to those videos.
Wow. So that takes some work on your part. You have to go manually enter each email into each of those 26 videos.
Yes, it takes me about 10 minutes to do it.
Oh, that's not
one
so
day,
bad. Okay.
One day I'll be able to trick my daughter to do it for free.
May it be so. Well, listen, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both very much for being here. Fascinating information. Anybody who wants to learn more about calibration, of course, I do recommend these videos. I've seen a few of them, and they are very, very informative and useful. And I want to thank you both, Michael Chen, for producing the videos and being here on the show to explain about them and also about calibration. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. And Ray Coronado, SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room. Now everyone has a face to associate with that handle. And your comments here are very valuable as well. And I thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. And anytime I can help.
You bet. That's one thing certainly about SoCal Ray Jr. is he's a very helpful fellow. So seek him out in the chat room and ask questions, and he will be happy to answer them, I'm sure, if he can. So you can go to Michael's website, which is TLVEXP, thelaserexperience.com. And you can go to Ray's website as well, which is SoCalHT.com. You can find me on AVS Forum at avsforum.com, also on Secrets of High Fidelity of Home Theater and High Fidelity at hometheaterhifi.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. And you can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on the Twit Network at twit.tv/htg. And it's even got its own YouTube channel now, which is youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Eric Gemmer, senior video engineer at THX. He was scheduled last week, and that got postponed. So he will be here next week to talk about THX certification of video displays and all the latest and greatest news in video technology. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.